Alice, could you have Bill and Alistair join me, please? They came in less than 3 minutes later. Listen to this one, guys, John said, hitting the play button on the tape machine. Bloody hell, Bill Tawney observed, a second before Al Stanley could do the same.
He wants to meet you. I wonder why.
Only one way to find out. I have to catch the Concorde for New York. Al, could you get Malloy awake so he can chopper me to Heathrow?
You're going?
Stanley asked. The answer was obvious.
Why not?
Hell, John grinned. It gets me out of the fucking budget meeting.
Quite so.
There could be dangers involved. I'll have the FBI send some people to look after me. And I'll have a friend with me, Clark pointed out, meaning his .45 Beretta. We're dealing with a professional spook here. There's more danger to him than there is to me, unless he's got a very elaborate operation set up at the other end. And we should be able to spot that. He wants to meet with me. He's a pro, and that means he wants to tell me something. Or maybe ask me something. But I'd lean the other way, right?
I'd have to agree with that, Tawney said.
Objections? Clark asked his principal subordinates. There were none. They were just as curious as he was, though they'd want good security in New York for the meeting. But that would not be a problem. Clark checked his watch. It's short of 4 in the morning there, and he wants the meet to be today. Pretty fast for this sort of thing. Why the hurry? Any ideas?
He could want to tell you that he had no connection with the hospital incident.
Aside from that? Tawney just shook his head.
Timing's a problem.
That's a 10:30 flight, John, Stanley pointed out. It's now 3:30 on your East Coast. No one important will be at work yet.
We'll just have to wake them up.
Clark looked at his phone and hit the speed dial button for FBI headquarters. FBI, another anonymous voice said. I need to talk to Assistant Director Chuck Baker.
I don't think Mr. Baker will be in now.
I know. Call him at home. Tell him that John Clark is calling. He could almost hear the, oh shit, at the other end of the call, but an order had been given by a voice that sounded serious, and it would have to be followed.
Hello, another voice said, somewhat groggily, a minute later.
Chuck, this is John Clark. Something's turned on the Seroff case.
What's that?
And why the hell can't it wait 4 hours? The voice didn't go on. John explained. He could hear the man waking up at the other end.
Okay, Baker said. I'll have some guys from New York meet you at the terminal, John.
Thanks, Chuck. Sorry to shake you loose at this hour.
Yeah, John. Bye.
The rest was easy. Malloy came into his office after his own morning workout and called to get his helicopter readied for a hop. It didn't take long. The only headache was having to filter through the in- and outbound airliner traffic. But the chopper landed at the General Aviation Terminal, and an airport security car took John to the proper terminal, where Clark was able to walk into the Speedway Lounge 20 minutes before the flight to collect his ticket. This way, he also bypassed security, and was thus spared the embarrassment of having to explain that he carried a pistol, which in the United Kingdom was the equivalent of announcing that he had a case of highly infectious leprosy. The service was British lavish, and he had to decline the offer of champagne before boarding the aircraft. Then the flight was called, and Clark walked down the jetway and into the world's fastest airliner for Flight 1 to New York's JFK International. The pilot gave the usual pre-flight brief, and a tractor pushed the oversized aircraft away from its gate. In less than 4 hours, John thought he'd be back in the States. Wasn't air travel wonderful? But better yet, he had in his lap the package that had just been couriered in. It was the personnel package for one Popov, Dmitri Arkadyevich. It had been heavily edited, he was sure, but even so it made for interesting reading, as the Concorde leaped into the air and turned west for America. "Thank you, Sergei Nikolaevich," John thought, flipping through the pages. It had to be the real KGB file John saw. Some of the photocopied pages showed pinholes in the upper left corners, which meant that they dated back to when KGB had used pins to keep pages together instead of staples, that having been copied from the British MI6 back in the 1920s. It was a piece of trivia that only insiders really knew. Clark was about halfway across the North Atlantic when Popoff awoke on his own again at 7:15. He ordered breakfast sent up and got himself clean in preparation for a busy day. By 8:15 he was walking out the front door, and looked first of all for a men's store that was open for business. That proved to be frustrating, until finally he found one whose doors opened promptly at 9. 30 minutes later, he had an expensive but somewhat ill-fitting gray suit, plus shirts and ties that he took back to his hotel room and into which he changed at once. Then it was time for him to walk to Central Park. The building that guarded the Central Park Zoo was strange to behold. It was made of brick and had battlements on the roof as though to defend the area against armed attack. But the same walls were dotted with windows, and the entire building sat in a depression rather than atop a hill, as a proper castle did. Well, American architects had their own ideas, Popoff decided. He circulated about the area, looking for the FBI agents, or perhaps CIA field officers, he wondered, who were certain to be there to cover this meeting. And possibly to arrest him? Well, there was nothing to be done about that. He would now learn if this John Clark were truly an intelligence officer. That business had rules, and Clark should follow them as a matter of professional courtesy. The gamble was a huge one on his part, and Clark had to respect it for that very reason. But he couldn't be sure. Well, one couldn't be sure of much in this world. Dr. Kilgore came to the cafeteria at his accustomed hour, but surprisingly didn't find his Russian friend, or Foster Honeycutt, there. Well, maybe they'd both slept late. He lingered over breakfast 20 minutes more than usual before deciding, the hell with it, and drove to the horse barn. There he found another surprise. Both Buttermilk and Jeremiah were in the corral, neither of them saddled or bridled. There was no way for him to know that both horses had walked back to their home on their own last night. Curious, he walked both back to their stalls before saddling up his own usual mount. He waited outside in the corral for another 15 minutes, wondering if his friends would show up. But they didn't, and he and Kirk McLean rode off west for their morning tour of the countryside. The covert side of the business could be fun, Sullivan thought. Here he was, driving what appeared to be a Consolidated Edison van, and wearing the blue coveralls that announced the same employment. The clothing was baggy enough to allow him to carry a dozen weapons inside the ugly garment, but, better yet, it made him effectively invisible. There were enough of these uniforms on the streets of New York that no one ever noticed them. This discreet surveillance mission had been laid on in one big hurry, with no fewer than 8 agents already at the rendezvous site, all carrying the passport photo of this Seroff subject, for what good it was. They lacked height and weight estimates, and that meant they were looking for an OWG, an ordinary white guy, of which New York City had at least 3 million. Inside the terminal, his partner, Frank Chatham, was waiting at the exit ramp off British Airways Flight 1, in a suit and tie. His coverall outfit was inside the Con Ed van that Sullivan had parked outside the terminal. They didn't even know who this Clark guy was whom they were meeting, just that Assistant Director Baker thought he was pretty fucking important. The aircraft got in exactly on time. Clark, in seat 1C, stood and was the first off the aircraft. The FBI escort at the jetway exit was easy to spot.
"Looking for me?"
"Your name, sir?"
"John Clark. Chuck Baker should have..."
"He did. Follow me, sir." Chatham led him out the fast way, bypassing Immigration and Customs, and it was just one more time that John's passport wouldn't be stamped to celebrate his entry into a sovereign country. The Con Ed van was easily spotted. Clark went for it without being told to and hopped in.
"Hi, I'm John Clark," he told the driver.
"Tom Sullivan. You've met Frank."
"Let's move, Mr. Sullivan," John told him.
"Yes, sir."
The van took off at once. In the back, Chatham sat and struggled into his blue coveralls.
"Okay, sir, what exactly is happening here?"
"I'm meeting a guy."
"Saroff?" Sullivan asked, as he negotiated his way onto the highway.
"Yeah, but his real name is Popov. Dmitry Arkadyevich Popov. He used to be a colonel in the old KGB. I have his personnel package, read it coming across. He's a specialist in dealing with terrorists, probably has more connections than the phone company."
"This guy set up the operation that..."
"Yeah."
John nodded in the front right passenger seat.
"The operation that went after my wife and my daughter. They were the primary targets."
"Shit," Chatham observed as he zipped his outfit up. "They hadn't known that. And you want to meet with this mutt?"
"Business is business, guys," John pointed out, wondering if he really believed that or not.
"So, who are you?"
"Agency. Used to be, anyway."
"How do you know Mr. Baker?"
"I have a slightly different job now, and we have to interface with the Bureau. Mainly with Gus Werner, but lately I've been talking with Baker, too."
"You part of the team that took down the bad guys at the hospital over in England?"
"I'm the boss of it," Clark told them.
"But don't go spreading that around, okay?"
"No problem," Sullivan replied.
"You're working the case on Mr. Saroff?"
"That's one of them we've got on the desk, yes."
"What you got on it?" John asked.
"Passport photo. I guess you have that."
"Better. I have his official KGB photo. Better than the passport one. It's like a mugshot, full face and profile. But it's 10 years old.
What else you have?"
"Bank accounts, credit card records, post office box. But no address yet. We're still working on that."
"What's he wanted for?" John asked next.
"Conspiracy, mainly," Sullivan answered. "Conspiracy to incite terrorism, conspiracy to traffic in illegal drugs. Those statutes are pretty broad, so that's what we use in cases where we don't have much of a clue as to what's really happening."
"Can you arrest him?"
"You bet. On sight," Chatham said in the back. "Do you want us to do that?"
"I'm not sure."
Clark settled into the uncomfortable seat and watched the approach of the New York skyline, still wondering what the hell this was all about. He'd find out soon enough, John told himself, thinking that it couldn't be soon enough to meet the fucker who'd sent armed men out after his wife and daughter. He managed a scowl at the approaching city that the FBI agents didn't notice. Popov thought that he had two FBI types spotted, not to mention a pair of uniformed police officers who might or might not be part of the surveillance that had to be assembling here. There was nothing for it, however. He had to meet with this Clark fellow, and that meant that the meet had to be in a public place. Else he'd have to walk right into the lion's den, something he could not bring himself to do. Here he'd have some chance. Just a matter, really, of walking south toward the subway station and racing down to catch a train. That would shake a lot of them off and give him options. Dump his suit coat and change his appearance, put on the hat he had tucked into a pants pocket. He figured he had about an even chance of evading contact if he had to, and there was little danger that anyone would shoot him. not in the heart of America's largest city. But his best chance was to communicate with Clark. If he were the professional Popoff believed him to be, then they could do business. They had to. There was no choice for either of them, Dmitri Arkadyevich told himself. The van crossed the East River and proceeded west through crowded streets. John checked his watch. "No problem, sir. We'll be about 10 minutes early," Sullivan told him. "Good," John replied tensely. It was coming soon now, and he had to get his emotions totally under control. A passionate man, John Terence Clark had more than once let them loose on a job. But he couldn't allow this now. Whoever this Russian was, he had invited him to the meeting. And that meant something. What, he could not yet know. But it had to mean that something unusual was afoot. And so he had to set aside all thoughts of past dangers to his immediate family. He had to be stone cold at this meeting, and so, sitting there in the front seat of the Con Ed truck, Clark told himself to breathe deeply and relax. And slowly he managed to accomplish that. Then his curiosity took over. This Russian had to know that Clark knew what he'd done, and still he'd asked for this meeting, and insisted on having it done speedily. That had to mean something, John told himself, as they broke through traffic and turned left onto Fifth Avenue. He checked his watch again. They were 14 minutes early. The van eased over to the right and stopped. Clark stepped out and headed south on the crowded sidewalk, past people selling used books and other gimcracks from what appeared to be portable wooden closets. Behind him, the FBI agents moved the van forward, stopped it close to the Meek building, and got out, carrying papers and looking around rather too obviously like Con Ed employees, John thought. Then he turned right and walked down the stairs and looked up at the red brick building that had been someone's idea of a castle 100 years or so before. It didn't take long. "Good morning, John Clark," a man's voice said behind him. "Good morning, Dmitri Arkadyevich," John replied, without turning at first. "Very good," the voice said approvingly. "I congratulate you on learning one of my names." "We have good intelligence support," John went on without turning. "You had a pleasant flight?" "A fast one. I've never done the Concorde before. It was not unpleasant." "So, Dmitri, what can I do for you?" "I must first of all apologize to you for my contacts with Grady and his people." "What about the other operations?" Clark asked as a dangle. Something of a gamble, but he was in a gambling mood. "Those did not concern you directly, and only one person was killed." "But that one was a sick little girl," John observed too quickly. "No, I had nothing to do with World Park. The bank in Bern and the stock trader outside Vienna. Yes, those were my missions, but not the amusement park." "So you have implicated yourself in 3 terrorist operations." "That is against the law, you know." "Yes, I am aware of that," the Russian replied dryly. "So what can I do for you?" John asked again. "It is more what I can do for you, Mr. Clark." "And that is?" Still, he didn't turn. But there had to be 6 FBI agents watching, maybe one with a shotgun microphone to record the exchange. In his haste to come over, Clark hadn't been able to get a proper recording system for his suit. "Clark, I can give you the reason for the missions, and the name of the man who instigated it all. It is quite monstrous. I only discovered yesterday, not even 24 hours ago, what the purpose for all of this is." "So?"
What is the objective? John asked.
To kill almost every human being on the planet, Popoff replied.
That made Clark stop walking and turn to look at the man. The KGB file mugshot was pretty good, he saw.
Is this some sort of movie script? He asked coldly.
Clark, yesterday I was in Kansas. There I learned the plan for this project. I shot and killed the person who told me so that I could escape. The man I killed was Foster Honeycutt, a hunter guide from Montana. I shot him in the chest with his own Colt 44 pistol. From there, I went to the nearest highway and managed to beg a ride to the nearest regional airport, from there to Kansas City, and from there to New York. I called you from my hotel room less than 8 hours ago.
Yes, Clark, I know you have the power to arrest me. You must have security watching us right now, presumably from your FBI, he said as they walked into the area with the animal cages.
And so you need only wave your hand, and I will be arrested. And I have just told you the name of the man I shot, and the location where it was done. Plus you have me for inciting terrorist incidents, and I presume for drug trafficking as well. I know this, yet I have asked for this meeting. Do you suppose that I am joking with you, John Clark?
Perhaps not. Rainbow Six answered, looking closely at the man.
Very well. And in that case, I propose that you have us taken to the local FBI office or some other secure place, so that I can give you the information you need under controlled circumstances. I require only your word that I will not be detained or arrested.
You would believe me if I were to say that?
Yes.
You are CIA, and you know the rules of the game, do you not?
Clark nodded.
Okay, you have my word. If you're telling me the truth.
John Clark, I wish I were not, Popoff said.
Truly, I wish I were not, Tovarich.
John looked hard into his eyes, and in them he saw fear. No, something deeper than fear. This guy had just called him comrade. That meant something, particularly under these circumstances.
Come on, John told him, turning around and heading for Fifth Avenue.
That's our subject, guys, a female agent said over the radio circuit. That is Subject Saroff, all gift-wrapped like a toy from FAO Schwartz.
Wait. They're turning around, heading east to Fifth.
No shit. Frank Chatham asked.
Then he saw them walking very quickly to where the van was parked.
You got a safe house around here? Clark asked.
Well, yeah, we do, but get us there right now, Clark ordered.
You can terminate your cover operation at once, too.
Get in, Dimitri, he said, opening the sliding door.
The safe house was only 10 blocks away. Sullivan parked the van, and all four men went inside.
Chapter 37 Dying Flame. The safe house was a 4-story brownstone that had been given to the federal government decades before by a grateful businessman whose kidnapped son had been recovered alive by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It was used mainly for interviewing UN diplomats who worked in one way or another for the U.S. government, and had been one of the places used by Arkady Shevchenko, still the highest-ranking Soviet defector of all time. Outwardly unremarkable, inside it had an elaborate security system and 3 rooms outfitted with recording systems and 2-way mirrors, plus the usual tables, and more comfortable chairs than normal. It was manned around the clock, usually by a rookie agent in the New York Field Division, whose purpose was merely that of doorman. Chatham took them to the top-floor interview room and sat Clark and Popoff down in the windowless cubicle. The microphone was set up, and the reel-to-reel tape recorder set to turning. Behind one of the mirrors, a TV camera and attendant VCR were set up as well.
"Okay," Clark said, announcing the date, time, and place.
"With me is Colonel Dmitry Arkadyevich Popov, retired, of the former Soviet KGB. The subject of this interview is international terrorist activity. My name is John Clark, and I am a field officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. Also here are Special Agent Tom Sullivan and Special Agent Frank Chatham of the FBI's New York office. Dmitry, would you please begin?" John said. It was intimidating as hell for Popov to do this, and it showed in the first few minutes of his narrative. The two FBI agents showed total incredulity on their faces for the first half hour, until he got to the part about his morning rides in Kansas.
"McLean. What was his first name?" Sullivan asked.
"Kirk, I think. Perhaps Kurt. But I think it ended with a K," Popov replied. "Honeycutt told me that he'd kidnapped people here in New York to be used as guinea pigs for this Shiva sickness."
"Fuck," Chatham breathed. "What does this guy look like?"
Popov told them in very accurate terms, down to hair length and eye color.
"Mr. Clark, we know this guy. We've interviewed him in the disappearance of a young woman, Mary Bannister. And another woman, Ann Pretlow, disappeared under very similar circumstances."
"Holy shit, you say they were murdered?"
"No. I said they were killed as test subjects for this Shiva disease that they plan to spread at Sydney.
Horizon Corporation. That's where this McLean guy works. He's out of town now, his co-workers told us."
"Yes, you will find him in Kansas," Popov told them with a nod.
"You know how big Horizon Corporation is?" Sullivan asked.
"Big enough."
"Okay, Dmitry," Clark said, turning back. "Exactly how do you think they will spread this virus?"
"Foster told me it was part of the air cooling system at the stadium. That is all I know."
John thought about the Olympics. They were running the marathon today, and that was the last event, to be followed by the closing ceremonies that evening. There wasn't time to think very much further than that. He turned, lifted the telephone, and dialed England.
"Give me Stanley," he told Mrs. Forgate.
"Alistair Stanley," the voice said next.
"Al, this is John. Get hold of Ding and have him call me here." John read the number off the phone.
"Right now. Immediately, Al. I mean right the hell now."
"Understood, John."
Clark waited 4.5 minutes by his watch before the phone rang.
"You're lucky he got me, John. I was just getting dressed to leave and watch the marathon."
"Shut the hell up and listen to me, Domingo," Clark said harshly.
"Yeah, John, go ahead," Chavez answered, getting out a pad to take some notes.
"Is this for real?" he asked after a few seconds.
"We believe it to be, Ding. It's like something from a bad movie."
Was this something concocted by Spectre? Chavez wondered. What was the potential profit in it for anybody?
"Ding, the guy giving this to me is named Serov, Yosef Andreyevich. He's here with me now."
"Okay, I hear you, Mr. C. When is this operation supposed to take place?"
"Around the time of the closing ceremonies, supposedly. Is there anything else today besides the marathon?"
"No, that's the last major event. And we ought not to be too busy till the race ends. We expect the stadium to start filling up around 5 this afternoon, and then they have the closing ceremonies, and everybody goes home."
"Including me," he didn't have to add.
"Well, that's their plan, Ding."
"And you want us to stop it?"
"Correct. Get moving. Keep this number. I'll be here all day on the Stu 4. From now on, all transmissions will be secure, okay?"
"You got it. Let me get moving, John."
"Move," the voice told him. "Bye."
Chavez hung up, wondering how the hell he'd do this. First he had to assemble his team. They were all on the same floor, and he went into the corridor, knocked on each door, and told the NCOs to come to his suite.
"Okay, people, we got a job to handle today. Here's the deal," he began, then spun the tale for about 5 minutes.
"Christ," Tomlinson managed to say for all of them.
The story was quite incredible, but they were accustomed to hearing and acting upon strange information.
"We have to find the control room for the fogging system. Once we do that, we'll put people in there. We'll rotate the duty. George and Homer, you start. Then Mike and I will relieve you. Call it 2-hour rotation inside and outside. Radios will be on at all times. Deadly force is authorized, people."
Noonan had heard the briefing, too.
"Ding, this whole thing sounds kinda unlikely."
"I know, Tim, but we act on it anyway."
"You say so, man."
"Let's move, people," Ding told them, standing.
"This is the day, Carol," John Breitling told his ex-wife. "Less than 10 hours from now, the project starts." She dropped Jigs on the floor and came to embrace him.
"Oh, John."
"I know," he told her. "It's been a long time.
Couldn't have done it without you."
Henriksen was there, too.
"Okay, I talked with Will Gehring 20 minutes ago. He'll be hooking up the Shiva dispenser right before they start the closing ceremonies. The weather is working for us, too. It's going to be another hot one in Sydney. Temperature's supposed to hit 97 degrees. So people'll be camping out under the foggers."
"And breathing heavily," Dr. John Breitling confirmed.
That was another of the body's methods for shedding excess heat.
Chavez was in the stadium now, already sweating from the building heat, and wondering if any of the marathon runners would fall over dead from this day's race. So Global Security, with whose personnel he'd interfaced briefly, was part of the mission. He wondered if he could remember all the faces he'd seen in the 2 brief conferences he'd had. But for now, he had to find Colonel Wilkerson. 5 minutes later, in the security reaction hut, he found the man.
"Good day, Major Chavez."
"Hey, Frank, I got a question for you."
"What's that, Ding?"
"The fogging system. Where's it come from?"
"The pumping room's by Section 5, just left of the ramp."
"How do I get in there?"
"You get a key to the door and the alarm code from me."
"Why, old boy?"
"Oh, well, I just want to see it."
"Is there a problem, Ding?" Wilkerson asked.
"Maybe." I got to thinking, Chavez went on, trying to formulate a persuasive lie for the moment. "What if somebody wanted to use it to dispense a chemical agent, like? And I thought I might..."
"Check it out?"
"One of the Global people beat you to that one, lad. Colonel Gehring. He checked out the entire installation. Same concern as you, but a bit earlier."
"Well, can I do it, too?"
"Why?"
"Call it paranoia," Chavez replied.
"I suppose."
Wilkerson rose from his chair and pulled the proper key off the wall. "The alarm code is 113366. 113366, Ding memorized.
"Good. Thanks, Colonel."
"My pleasure, Major,"
the SAS Lieutenant Colonel replied.
Chavez left the room, rejoined his people outside, and headed rapidly back to the stadium.
"Did you tell him about the problem?" Noonan asked.
Chavez shook his head.
"I wasn't authorized to do that. John expects us to handle it."
"What if our friends are armed?"
"Well, Tim, we are authorized to use necessary force, aren't we?"
"Could be messy," the FBI agent warned, worried about local laws and jurisdictions.
"Yeah, I suppose so. We use our heads okay. We know how to do that, too."
Kirk McLean's job at the project was to keep an eye on the environmental support systems, mainly the air conditioning and the overpressurization system, whose installation he didn't really understand. After all, everyone inside the buildings would have the B vaccine shot.
And even if Shiva got in, there wasn't supposed to be any danger. But he supposed that John Breitling was merely being redundant in his protective system's thinking. And that was okay with him. His daily work was easily dealt with. It mainly involved checking dials and recording systems, all of which were stuck in the very center of normal operating ranges. And then he felt like a ride. He walked into the transport office and took a set of keys for a Project Hummer, then headed out to the barn to get his horse. Another 20 minutes, and he'd saddled his quarter horse and headed north, cantering across the grassland, through the lanes in the wheat fields where the farm machines turned around, taking his time through one of the prairie dog towns, and heading generally toward the interstate highway that formed the northern edge of the project's real estate. About 40 minutes into the ride, he saw something unusual. Like every rural plot of land in the American West, this one had a resident buzzard population. Here, as in most such places, they were locally called turkey buzzards, regardless of the actual breed, large raptors that ate carrion and were distinctive for their size and their ugliness. Black feathers and naked, red-skinned heads that carried large, powerful beaks designed for ripping flesh off the carcasses of dead animals. They were nature's garbage collectors, or nature's own morticians, as some put it, important parts of the ecosystem, though distasteful to some. He saw about 6 of them circling something in the tall grass to the northeast. 6 was a lot. Then he realized that there were more still, as he spotted the black, angular shapes in the grass from 2 miles away. Something large had evidently died, and they had assembled to clean, eat it up. They were careful, conservative birds. Their circling and examination was to ensure that whatever they saw and smelled wasn't still alive, and hence able to jump up and injure them when they came down to feed. Birds were the most delicate of creatures, made mostly for air, and needing to be in perfect condition to fly and survive. What are they eating? McLean wondered, heading his horse over that way at a walk, not wanting to spook the birds any more than necessary, and wondering if they were afraid of a horse and rider. Probably not, he thought, but he'd find out about this little bit of nature's trivia. Whatever it was, he thought 5 minutes later, the birds liked it. It was an ugly process, McLean thought, but no more so than when he ate a burger, at least as far as the cow was concerned. It was nature's way. The buzzards ate the dead and processed the protein, then excreted it out, returning the nutrients back to the soil, so that the chain of life could proceed again in its timeless cycle of life, death, life. Even from 100 yards away, there were too many birds for him to determine what they were feasting on. Probably a deer or pronghorn antelope, he thought, from the number of birds and the way they bobbed their heads up and down, consuming the creature that nature had reclaimed for herself. What did pronghorns die of? Kirk wondered. Heart attacks? Strokes? Cancer? It might be interesting to find out in a few years. Maybe have one of the project physicians do a post-mortem on one. If they got there ahead of the buzzards, which, he thought with a smile, ate up the evidence. But at 50 yards he stopped his horse. Whatever they were eating seemed to be wearing a plaid shirt. With that he urged his horse closer. And at 10 yards the buzzards took notice, first swiveling their odious red heads and cruel black eyes, then hopping away a few feet, then, finally, flapping back into the air. "Oh, fuck," McLean said quietly, when he got closer. The neck had been ripped away, leaving the spine partly exposed. And in some places the shirt had been shredded, too, by the powerful beaks. The face had also been destroyed, the eyes gone, and most of the skin and flesh.
but the hair was fairly intact, and...
Jesus. Foster? What happened to you, man?
It required a few more feet of approach to see the small red circle in the center of the dark shirt. McLean didn't dismount his horse. A man was dead, and, it appeared, had been shot dead. Kirk looked around and saw the hoof prints of one or two horses right here. Probably two, he decided. Backing away, he decided to get back to the project as quickly as his horse could manage. It took 15 minutes, which left his quarter horse winded and the rider shaken. He jumped off, got into his Hummer, and raced back to the project, and found John Kilgore. The room was grossly nondescript, Chavez saw. Just pipes, steel and plastic, and a pump, which was running, as the fogging cooling system had started off from its timer a few minutes before. And Chavez's first thought was, what if the bug's already in the system? I just walked through it, and what if I breathed the fucking thing in? But here he was. And if that were the case... But no, John had told him that the poisoning was to start much later in the day, and that the Russian was supposed to know what was going on. You had to trust your intelligence sources. You just had to. The information they gave you was the currency of life and death in this business. Noonan bent down to look at the chlorine canister that hung on the piping. It looks like a factory product, Ding, the FBI agent said, for what that was worth. I can see how you switch 'em out. Flip off the motor here, he pointed. Close this valve. Twist this off with a wrench like the one on the wall there. Swap on the new one. Reopen the valve and hit the pump motor. Looks like a 30-second job, maybe less. Boom, 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 and you're done. And if it's already been done? Chavez asked. Then we're fucked, Noonan replied. I hope your intel's good on this, partner. The fog outside had the slight smell of chlorine, Chavez told himself, hopefully, like American city water. And chlorine was used because it killed germs. It was the only element besides oxygen that supported combustion, wasn't it? He'd read that somewhere, Domingo thought. What do you think, Tim? I think the idea makes sense, but it's one hell of a big operation for somebody to undertake, and it's... Ding, who the hell would do something like this? And why, for Christ's sake? I guess we have to figure that one out. But for now, we watch this thing like it's the most valuable gadget in the whole fucking world, okay? Ding turned to look at his men. George and Homer, you guys stay here. If you gotta take a piss, do it on the floor. There was a drainage pit there, they all saw. Mike and I will handle things outside. Tim, you stay close, too. We got our radios, and that's how we communicate. 2 hours on, 2 hours off, but never more than 50 yards from this place. Questions? Nope, Sergeant Tomlinson said for the rest. If somebody comes in and tries to fool with this, you stop him any way you have to. And you call for help on your radios. Rajo, boss, George said. Homer Johnston nodded agreement. Chavez and the other two went back outside. The stadium had filled up, people wanting to see the start of the marathon. And then what? Ding wondered. Just sit here and wait for 3 hours? No, about 2.5. That was about the usual championship time, wasn't it? 26 miles. 42 kilometers or so. One hell of a long way for a man, or a woman, to run. A daunting distance even for him, Chavez admitted to himself. A distance better suited to a helicopter lift or a ride in a truck. He, Pierce, and Noonan walked to one of the ramps and watched the TVs hanging there. By this time the runners were assembling for the crowded start. The favorites were identified, some of them given up-close and personal TV biographies. The local Australian commentary discussed the betting on the event, who the favorites were,
and what the odds were. Smart money seemed to be on a Kenyan, though there was an American who'd blown away the record for the Boston Marathon the previous year by almost half a minute. Evidently a large margin for such a race. And a 30-year-old Dutchman, who was the dark horse among the favorites. 30, and a competitor in an Olympic competition, Chavez thought. Good for him.
"Command to Tomlinson," Chavez said over his radio.
"I'm here, Command. Nothing much happening, except this damn pump noise. I'll call you if anything happens. Over."
"Okay, Command out."
"So, what do we do now?" Mike Pierce asked.
"Wait. Stand around and wait."
"You say so, boss," Pierce responded.
They all knew how to wait, though none of them especially liked it.
"Christ," Kilgore observed.
"You sure?"
"You want to drive out and see?" McLean asked heatedly.
Then he realized that they'd have to do that anyway, to collect the body for proper burial. Now McLean understood Western funeral customs. It was bad enough to see vultures pick a deer's body apart. To see the same thing happening to a human being whom you knew was intolerable, love for nature or not.
"You say he was shot?"
"Sure looked like it."
"Great."
Kilgore lifted his phone.
"Bill, it's John Kilgore. Meet me in the main lobby right away. We have a problem, okay?"
"Good."
The physician replaced the phone and rose. "Come on," he said to McLean. Henriksen arrived in the lobby of the residential building 2 minutes after they did, and together they drove in a Hummer north to where the body was. Again the buzzards had to be chased off, and Henriksen, the former FBI agent, walked up to take a look. It was as distasteful as anything he'd seen in his law enforcement career.
"He's been shot, all right," he said, first of all. "Big bullet, right through the X-ring."
The wound had been a surprise for Honeycutt, he thought, though there wasn't enough of the man's face left to tell, really. There were ants on the body as well, he saw. Damn, Henriksen thought. He'd been depending on this guy to help with perimeter security once the project went fully active. Somebody had murdered an important project asset. But who?
"Who else hung out with Foster?" Bill asked.
"The Russian guy, Popov."
"We all rode together," McLean answered.
"Hey," Kilgore said. "Their horses were out this morning. Jeremiah and Buttermilk were both in the corral, both unsaddled and—"
"Here's the saddle and bridle," Henriksen said, 15 feet away.
"Okay, somebody shot Honeycutt and then stripped the tack gear off his horse."
"Okay, so nobody would see a riderless horse with a saddle on it."
"We have a murder here, people. Let's find Popov right now. I think I need to talk to him. Anybody see him lately?"
"He didn't show up for breakfast this morning like he usually does," Kilgore revealed. "We've been eating together for a week or so, then taking a morning ride. He liked it."
"Yeah," McLean confirmed, "we all did. You think he—"
"I don't think anything yet."
"Okay, let's get the body into the Hummer and head back. John, can you do a post on this?"
This seemed a cold appellation for a dead colleague, Kilgore thought, but he nodded.
"Yeah, doesn't look like it'll be too hard."
"Okay, you get the feet," Bill said next, bending down and trying to avoid touching the parts the buzzards had feasted on. 20 minutes later, they were back in the project. Henriksen went up to Popoff's fourth-floor room and used his pass key to get in. Nothing, he saw. The bed hadn't been slept in. He had a suspect. Popov had killed Honeycutt, probably. But why? And where the hell was that Russian bastard now? It took half an hour to check around the project complex. The Russian was nowhere to be found. That made sense, since his horse had been found loose that morning by Dr. Kilgore. Okay, the former FBI agent thought. Popov had killed Honeycutt and then skipped. But skipped where?
He'd probably ridden to the interstate highway and thumbed a ride. Or maybe walked to a bus stop or something. It was a mere 25 miles to the regional airport, and from there the bastard could be in Australia by now, Henriksen had to admit to himself. But why would he have done any of that?
"John," he asked Kilgore, "what did Popoff know?"
"What do you mean?"
"What did he know about the project?"
"Not much. Breitling didn't really brief him in, did he?"
"No."
"Okay, what did Honeycutt know?"
"Shit, Bill, Foster knew everything."
"Okay, then we think Popoff and Honeycutt went riding last night. Honeycutt turns up dead and Popoff isn't anywhere to be found. So could Honeycutt have told Popoff what the project is doing?"
"I suppose, yes," Kilgore confirmed with a nod.
"So Popoff finds out, gets Foster's revolver, shoots him, and bugs the hell out."
"Christ, you think he might—"
"Yes, he might. Shit, man, anybody might."
"But we'd got the B vaccine in him. I gave him the shot myself."
"Oh, well," Bill Henriksen observed.
"Oh, shit," his brain went on. "Will Gehring's going to initiate Phase 1 today."
As if he could have forgotten.
He had to talk to Breitling right away.
Both Doctors Breitling were in the penthouse accommodations atop the residence building, overlooking the runway, which now had 4 Gulfstream 5 business jets on it. The news Henriksen delivered wasn't pleasing to either of them.
"How bad is this?" John asked.
"Potentially it's pretty bad," Bill had to admit.
"How close are we to—"
4 hours or less," Henriksen replied.
"Does he know that?"
"It's possible, but we can't know for sure."
"Where would he have gone?" Carol Breitling asked.
"Shit, I don't know. CIA, FBI, maybe. Popoff's a trained spook. In his position, I'd go to the Russian embassy in D.C. and tell the resident. He'll have credibility there, but the time zones and bureaucracy work for us. KGB can't do anything fast, Carol. They'll spend hours trying to swallow whatever he tells them."
"Okay.
So we proceed?" John Breitling asked.
A nod.
"Yeah, I think so. I'll call Will Gehring to give him a heads up, maybe."
"Can we trust him?" John inquired next.
"I think so, yes. I mean, hell yes. He's been with us for years, guys. He's part of the project. If we couldn't trust him, we'd all be fucking in jail now. He knows about the test protocols in Binghamton, and nobody interfered with that, did they?"
John Breitling leaned back in his chair.
"You're saying we can relax?"
"Yeah," Henriksen decided. "Look, even if the whole thing comes apart, we're covered, aren't we? We turn out the B vaccine instead of the A one. And we're heroes for the whole world. Nobody can trace the missing people back to us unless someone cracks and talks. And there are ways to handle that. There's no physical evidence that we've done anything wrong. At least none that we can't destroy in a matter of minutes, right?"
That part had been carefully thought through. All of the Shiva virus containers were a 2-minute walk from the incinerators both here and at Binghamton. The bodies of the test subjects were ashes. There were people with personal knowledge of what had happened, but for any of them to talk to the authorities meant implicating themselves in mass murder. And they'd all have attorneys present to shield them through the interrogation process. It would be a twitchy time for all involved, but nothing that they couldn't beat.
"Okay."
John Breitling looked at his wife. They'd worked too hard and too long to turn back. They'd both endured separation from their loves to serve their greater love for nature, invested time and vast funds to do this. No, they couldn't turn back.
And if this Russian talked, to whom they couldn't speculate, even then, could those he talked to stop the project in time? That was scarcely possible.
Husband, physician, scientist, traded a look with wife, scientist, and then both looked at their director of security.
Tell Gehring to proceed, Bill.
Okay, John. Henriksen stood and headed back to his office.
Yes, Bill, Colonel Gehring said.
No big deal. Proceed as planned and call me to confirm the package is delivered properly.
Okay, Will Gehring replied.
Anything else I have to do?
I have plans of my own, you know.
Like what? Henriksen asked.
I'm flying up north tomorrow. Going to take a few days to dive the Great Barrier Reef.
Oh, yeah? Well, don't let any sharks eat you.
Right, was the laughing reply, and the line cut off.
Okay, Bill Henriksen thought. That's decided. He could depend on Gehring. He knew that. He'd come to the project after a life of poisoning things, and he, too, knew the rest of the project's activities. If he'd ratted to anybody, they would not have gotten this far. But it'd have been so much better if that Russian cocksucker hadn't skipped. What could he do about that? Report Honeycutt's murder to the local cops, and finger Popoff, Serov, as the likely killer? Was that worth doing? What were the possible complications? Well, Popoff could spill what he knew, however much or little that might be, but then they could say that he was a former KGB spy who'd acted strangely, who'd done some consulting to Horizon Corporation. But Jesus, started terrorist incidents in Europe? Be serious. This guy's a murderer with imagination, trying to fabricate a story to get himself off a cold-blooded killing right here in Middle America. Would that work?
It might, Henriksen decided. It just might work. And take that bastard right the hell out of play. He could say anything he wanted. But what physical evidence did he have? Not a fucking thing.
Popoff poured a drink from a bottle of Stolichnaya that the FBI had been kind enough to purchase from a corner liquor store. He had 4 previous drinks in his system. That helped to mellow his outlook somewhat.
So, John Clark, we wait.
Yeah, we wait. Rainbow Six agreed.
You have a question for me?
Why did you call me?
We've met before.
Where?
In your building in Hereford. I was there with your plumber under one of my legends.
I wondered how you knew me by sight, Clark admitted, sipping a beer. Not many people from your side of the curtain do.
You do not wish to kill me now?
The thoughts occurred to me, Clark replied, looking in Popoff's eyes. But I guess you have some scruples after all. And if you're lying to me, you'll soon wish you were dead.
Your wife and daughter are well?
Yes, and so is my grandson.
That is good, Popoff announced.
That mission was a distasteful one. You have done distasteful missions in your career, John Clark?
He nodded.
Yeah, a few.
So then, you understand?
Not the way you mean, sport, Rainbow Six thought before responding.
Yeah, I suppose I do, Dmitri Arkadyevich.
How did you find my name? Who told you?
The answer surprised him.
Sergei Nikolaevich and I are old friends.
Ah, Popoff managed to observe without fainting.
His own agency had betrayed him?
Was that possible?
Then it was as if Clark had read his mind.
Here, John said, handing over the sheaf of photocopies.
Your evaluations are pretty good.
Not good enough, Popoff replied, failing to recover from the shock of viewing items from a file that he had never seen before.
Well, the world changed, didn't it?
Not as completely as I had hoped.
I do have a question for you.
Yes?
The money you gave to Grady, where is it?
In a safe place, John Clark. The terrorists